Consider this. If you have a smartphone in your pocket, you're potentially carrying a casino in your pocket. Local governments have helped transform gambling from an industry controlled by gangsters in the past to an above-board, legitimate source of revenue. This is where we begin our conversation with journalist David Clary. His new book is Gangsters to Governors, The New Bosses of Gambling in America. He's a news editor at the San Diego Union-Tribune. David, welcome to the program.
Okay, thanks so much for having me.
Well, you open your book by telling the story of Revel, this Atlantic City casino that failed to make it. And you say that Revel's colossal failure really shows how intertwined the fates of governors and gambling have become, how closely knit they are. Can you tell us the story of the Revel?
Sure. So what happened is Governor Chris Christie, governor of New Jersey, he came into office in 2009, and one of his big agenda items was to revive Atlantic City. Atlantic City has been in a state of decline gambling-wise for quite a while. There's been so much competition from neighboring states like Pennsylvania. And he really pressed hard to make Atlantic City great again, I guess you could say. One of the big projects in Atlantic City was Revel Casino. It cost over $2 billion to construct. It's a giant tower right on the boardwalk. And the construction of it stalled. It was because it was so expensive. And Christie actually put a lot of state resources into restarting construction. A lot of state tax credits went to that casino. And he personally staked a lot of prestige on this project. So the casino opened, and it just didn't do very well. It was just not the right time. The marketplace just wasn't ready for something that big. And in a couple of years, it closed. And then it eventually got sold off, I think, for $82 million. So you know, you go from a project that cost over $2 billion to something that was sold off for a fraction of that cost. And now the casino is empty. It hasn't been occupied for a couple of years now.
And
so it really does show just governors are so accustomed and they're so used to this revenue and they want to protect it and expand it at all costs. And I just felt like that was a real shining example of that, of the kind of the desire that governors have to just hold on to that revenue and expand it any way they can.
And this casino in New Jersey, it was opening well after the Great Recession. This is early 2012 now. Economy is recovered. It's picking up. And a new casino is opening. Why didn't it make it?
Yeah, like I said, it was really, it just was the timing was poor. Yeah, it was after the recession, but Atlantic City had already been in a state of decline when it comes to gambling revenue. Actually, Pennsylvania has outpaced New Jersey in terms of commercial casino revenue, which was a kind of surprise to me when I researched this book. You always think of Nevada and Atlantic City as the two big casino markets, but Pennsylvania has outpaced it, and it outpaced it years ago. A lot of the players from Atlantic City came from Philadelphia in New York City, and if you have a casino in your own market, you're not likely to make the trip out to Atlantic City just to gamble. So, back when Atlantic City had a monopoly on casino gambling on the East Coast for many years, and it was extremely successful, but it started to be in a state of decline by the time Christie took office, and then I think the year Revel closed, three other casinos closed in Atlantic City. So about a third of all the casinos were no longer open. And it's just never picked up. And it's you're really throwing good money after bad, trying to prop up that market.
Reading this story and others in your book jogged my memory of covering a groundbreaking ceremony in Louisiana for Margaritaville property, and I want to say this was maybe around 2012, 2013-ish, and it was paled in comparison, maybe a $700 million project, not huge in scope, but in order to build this property, they had to change the course of the river because the casino part of it was going to be on the river, in so that the gambling would be on the river, but the hotel property and the restaurants and the shopping were on dry land. But they had to change the course of the river in order to build this football field size enclosure to put a floating casino
on the river.
So I'm wondering, where did this whole riverboat gambling come from, and how we see casinos dotting the landscape on rivers?
Yeah, that, I remember when that happened, and it just shows, it really does show the power of casino or gambling revenue, is that states are willing to redirect rivers in order to get benefits from casino gambling. It really, one thing, I did a lot of deep historical research, and gambling is just such a part of American culture, and going back to the colonial era, and especially with riverboat gaming, once we had steamboats and down the Mississippi back in the 1800s, almost immediately people gambled on them, and that was sort of part of the culture of gambling in our in our rivers. And the first state to have riverboat gambling was Iowa. I think it was back in 1985, the mid-80s. And actually, the one governor I talked to on the record for this book was Governor Terry Branstad, who was governor of Iowa, and he was governor at that time when they legalized riverboat gaming. And he was the longest-serving governor in American history, so he was actually a really great person to talk to because he's been there so long, so you can have the
historical context.
Yeah, the historical sweep of it. So, and he said it was just something that the people wanted, and he wasn't necessarily that excited about it, but it was the legislature pushed it, and they needed some revenue, and they went for it. And then, as what also often happens with forms of gambling, once one state legalizes it, then it's sort of a domino effect where the neighboring states also legalize it because they don't want to see their players or their citizens go to other states to spend their money. So once Iowa gave the green light to it, then pretty much every other state on the Mississippi River followed within a few years. And then what often happens is that states will increase their betting limits. They'll increase the number of hours that a riverboat's allowed to be on the river. They'll loosen a lot of regulations to increase revenue and make their gambling platforms more attractive.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with journalist David Clary. His new book is Gangsters to Governors, The New Bosses of Gambling in America. We're looking at the course of history for casinos and how local governments have really glommed on to this revenue source. David, is this a partisan issue, or have both Republicans and Democrats gone in on this shift toward legalized forms of gambling?
Yeah, I see this as one of our few last remaining bipartisan issues. If you look across the landscape, there's 48 states have some form of legalized gambling, so that and in some states it's entrenched. We talked about New Jersey. That's the Republican governor, Chris Christie, who's been very aggressive about expanding gambling in his state in all forms, not just the casinos, but in online gambling, and he's pushed very hard for sports gambling, which is a major case before the Supreme Court this term.
Yeah, in December.
And and then also Oklahoma, is considered a conservative state, and there's dozens of casinos across that state. If you look at New York State, it's a Democratic governor who's trying to expand gambling, casino gambling. If you look across the country, it's Republicans and Democrats that are pushing it hard, or at least not doing anything to roll it back. They at least want to maintain where they are.
And in Iowa, you said it's because the people wanted it. Did they have proof that this was really being backed by the citizens, or was this an initiative led by politicians?
I think that one was really more of a politicians led that. And I think the argument also was that the state had just legalized the lottery, And, you know, once you legalize one form of gambling, it's hard to say that, you know, another form is not proper. You know, it undercuts that argument. So
it's a domino.
I mean, once you open the door to it and you say, well, yeah, lotteries are okay, then it's hard to say, well, you know, riverboat casinos aren't okay. So so it just gets easier to legalize other forms once you've already opened the door to it.
Following the Great Recession, at least a dozen states passed laws expanding gaming options, such as the allowance of casinos in Maryland and Massachusetts. State lawmakers across the country typically see legal gambling as an economically painless way to close budget gaps. We're discussing the history right now with David Clary. He's the author of Gangsters to Governors. Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Should states be pinning their financial hopes on gambling? Join us. So many states have gotten into the game, 48 states to be exact, where gambling is legal. We're exploring the colorful and fraught backstory of gambling this hour, tracing its evolution from a mob-run business to one that state lawmakers regularly use through policy. States are even more hopeful that fantasy sports could open a new taxable marketplace because these games appeal to a younger generation of gambler who is only lukewarm about lotteries and traditional casinos. Journalist David Clary is with us. His new book is Gangsters to Governors, The New Bosses of Gambling in America. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Should states be pinning their financial hopes on gambling, casinos, and other forms of gaming? How big of a role should the government play when it comes to gambling and gambling regulation? Do you find the country's gambling laws to be too loose or too restrictive? Join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. David, the part of your book that really struck me was how gaming has been so much a part of government, even from the inception, with this Louisiana State Lottery Company got its foothold in Louisiana and then just permeated all over the country. What happened back in the 1800s?
Yeah, that was a fascinating case. I had no knowledge of that before I started writing the book, and that's one of the real treats of writing a book, is you get to delve into this research and you learn things you never would have known otherwise. So it was the lotteries were very popular as a form of raising revenue going back to the colonial era. In the early American era, there really weren't that many banks around then. So if you wanted to build a bridge in your community or you wanted to build a church, that holding a lottery was a way of doing it. It was a way of raising money. And over time, they became kind of more of a big business and corrupt. And a lot of states decided to ban them. And then ultimately, the only one left was the one that you mentioned, Louisiana State Lottery. And that it became a nationwide phenomenon. And it was really the only, it was just a quirk in the law that allowed that to expand. And so you could buy those lottery tickets across the country. And that it became so powerful that it almost it really did control the state and has tentacles and, you know, across the country. So it became so big that actually it took Congress, it took the President of the United States, it took the Supreme Court to knock it down. And so it took a while for that to actually be exterminated, but once it was, we didn't see lotteries in this country and for about 60 or 70 years, legal lotteries in this country. And during that time, it became an underground pursuit. You know, you hear about the numbers rackets. You know, that's what the lottery is. And the numbers rackets helped fund organized crime activities.
And to appease governments, these lottery companies like the Louisiana State Lottery would give a lump sum dollar amount to government to say, here's what you can use for your people, so to speak. And they kept upping the ante on how much that would be. It went from like a paltry $40,000 at one point, and then it was over $1 million. And then lawmakers were voting on how much they could get from the revenue from these from the gambling company. So it was really the gambling company in control.
Yeah, and we see echoes of that today. You know, where I think just this week, the state of Pennsylvania increased they had to pass their budget, and they decided to one way to pass the budget was to increase casino gambling, and because I think governors going back to that the Louisiana state lottery days, they see gambling as a painless tax. You know, no governor wants to raise people's taxes. They don't want to raise income taxes. Some states don't have an income tax, so states they look for any way to balance their budget. And for many of them, they just look at that gambling as a very easy way of doing that, a painless way of doing that. But of course, there are side effects to it. It really isn't painless.
And as you mentioned, in Pennsylvania this week, gambling will now be legal in places like airports and truck stops,
right.
So making
That's
it
right.
much more pervasive. You also point out, you go to Mississippi in your book and look at what happened in Tunica, a very, very poor area, but got a casino and really at initially turned itself around, but then the area went back to being very poor, very uneducated. There was this economic confusion at the beginning, and then what happens? Why does it go back to not to becoming economically depressed again?
Yeah, I think what we see when you have casino gambling hubs like you have in Mississippi and Atlantic City, where you've got a lot of casinos in a very concentrated area, I think what we've seen is that it works for a while, and it's because you go from nothing to something. So you of course you'll see an increase in revenue and sometimes a decline in poverty rates, but in order to keep it up, it's difficult because we have a thousand casinos in this country. You know, about 500 are Indian casinos and 500 are commercial casinos. So it's no longer a novelty, and I think it's not enough just to offer thousands of slot machines and a lot of table games. Back in the 80s, that was a novel pursuit, but it's commonplace now, and like you said in your intro, I mean you can gamble online, and that wasn't around back then, of course. So gambling is just so much more pervasive now, and it's no longer kind of a special thing. So they've seen a decline in Mississippi, as you've seen in Atlantic City, when there's just too many casinos in a crowded market, and then you have neighboring states that get into the casino business, and then that's when you really start seeing a difficulty in maintaining revenue.
And where that revenue goes is also quite interesting if you follow the money, perhaps as you did, to see where states are putting this gambling revenue that comes in. Is it building infrastructure? Is it going to social services? So where are they putting these dollars?
Yeah, a lot of states, it's interesting. They really promote lotteries, because a lot of the lotteries, they are run by the states. And they really promote it as a public good. You know, if you play the lottery or you gamble, you're performing a public service almost. You know, and because a lot of states channel gambling money toward public education or to property tax relief or to help the elderly, so they really promote it as something that's a civic good. And And they do everything they can do to expand it. You know, states, they advertise for the lottery, so there's state money that's spent to advertise the lottery, and they want people to play more. You know, if you don't, you have to play more to increase the revenue. So they're encouraging people to do more and to bet more. And if they raise the price of tickets, and they here in California, there's you can buy tickets at probably hundreds and hundreds of places, grocery stores and 7-Elevens, and 24/7 you can buy lottery tickets.
And these lotteries are also very much branded by images of the state and symbols in the state.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah. Let's take a call now. Let's go to Artis in Richland Center. Hi, Artis. Go ahead.
Good morning. I have to admit, I've never been much of a gambler, but when I decided these people sit around and look at the estate, the money that's coming into the market, whatever, I think, well, they worry about their money growing. Well, I decided I'd buy power tickets, Powerball, mainly. Anyway, I have a daughter who works with Antigo and the casino up there. She's not in that. She's a marketer. I have been trying to tell her. She seems to have a good reputation in what she's doing. And I said, you just have to get a hold of your politicians, whoever they represent in that area, and I don't know who they are, and work with them. Between the two sets of them, they could bring more revenue into the state of Wisconsin. And, I mean, just not Antigol, but all around, because her place she's at is, I guess, a large one. There are smaller ones around, but it's a good area to bring into Wisconsin for everything.
And as Arda says, you know, here in Wisconsin, if you go to a casino, chances are it'll be a Native American casino. And you've got a chapter in the book about the rise of tribal casinos and the often tense relationship between tribal leaders and state politicians over these gaming issues. How strained has that relationship been?
It certainly has been strained. I think a lot of people don't realize is that, you know, these are sovereign governments, you know, they really have their own power, and so states have to come to agreements with tribes when it comes to gaming, and it's difficult because they are both sovereign governments, and it's been fraught. And but it's a big business, and like I said, about 500 Indian-run casinos across the country, and here in California, there are no commercial casinos; they're all tribal-run casinos, and I think that's the case in a lot of states where the Constitution will say that a casino has to be tribal-run; it can't be run by a corporation or, you know, a mainstream gambling company. So they do have a lot of political clout, and they have a lot of power. You know, sometimes in California, they've been trying to promote online betting, and the tribes have shot that down, and because they don't want that to curb their business. So yeah, it's definitely been a tense relationship going back to the 70s, really.
Let's go to Jim now in Larson. Hi, Jim. Go ahead.
Good morning. Now, Nevada, the way they have their game set up, obviously they're paying quite a bit to the state because they have no state income tax there. How come that's not suit throughout the rest of the states that have casinos in there? And where does all the money go? How does it get distributed? Because there's an astronomical amount of money that comes through the doors every day in every casino.
Yeah, following the money trail. David, where does it go?
Yeah, well, like I said, a lot of times it goes to public education explicitly, especially in the case of lotteries. Sometimes it just goes directly into the general fund. I think one troubling thing that I've seen with how states channel their gambling revenue is that oftentimes, what it does is it allows them to spend less on something. So they may take in a chunk of money for public education that's derived from casinos or lotteries. But what that does is it really allows them to spend less on education from their general fund budget. So the real amount of money that the state actually spends on education ends up being less. Mm-hmm. And so I've seen that in a variety of states in recent years. So that's a troubling thing where, you know, they claim that it helps fund education, and it does, but what it really does is it allows them to kind of play with the books and spend less on from their general funds.
If you're just joining us, we're with journalist David Clary. His new book is Gangsters to Governors, The New Bosses of Gambling in America. We're looking at the history of gambling in America, where it is today, and tracing this close relationship it has in states with local governments and where the dollars go in local government and how states are basically glomming on to gambling and making it more accessible to their residents. You can join in the discussion, 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the past, present, and the future of gambling in America? Do you find the country's gambling laws to be too loose or too restrictive? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. David, on the federal level, how regulated is gambling and how much is left up to the states?
Well, I think we mentioned earlier there's a really important case that the Supreme Court is hearing this term. I think the oral arguments are in
December.
We should have a ruling by June. What that looks at is a federal ban on sports betting. It's from a 1992 federal law. And so there's only one state, Nevada, that offers single-game sports betting. And what's happened is that New Jersey has sued to claiming that they should be able to offer sports betting, sports books at their casinos in Atlantic City. So this case has been knocking around the lower courts since 2009, and then finally it's come to the Supreme Court to decide. So that very well could open up sports books in states across the country. There's already about a dozen states that have them ready to go. You know, if the Supreme Court says, you know, this law is unconstitutional and this federal law is unconstitutional and states can offer the sports betting, I think you'll see that landscape change very quickly. And potentially you could see dozens of states offering sports betting within their casinos, which would certainly be a big transformation. So that's the federal. That's one case where the federal government has had quite a say over betting in our country.
Let's go to Anna now in Lake Geneva. Hi, Anna. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm just inquiring, as more gambling facilities are available to the public, is the government or anybody doing anything to assist with people that have gambling addiction?
Well, that's a great question. That was something that always haunted me during this the research of this, because I think whenever you have an increase in gambling options, you're going to have more cases of problem gambling. So I spent an afternoon at a Gamblers Anonymous meeting here in San Diego, and they were generous enough to let me sit there and listen to their stories. And yeah, the stories are harrowing. I mean, these are people that are, a lot of them were in their 50s and 60s, and they were well-dressed, and you would never have any inkling that they, you know, had these major issues. And they'd tell these stories about how they would lie to their spouse about, you know, where their money is or where they've been. They had problems with their job and their children. They would gamble hundreds of thousands of dollars, you know, their whole life savings at the racetrack or at the local casino. And it was really eye opening, you know, to hear those stories and to meet those people. And I think states have not done a good job at addressing those issues. Many states offer no money at all to help treat people, or even states that offer gambling offer little money.
And we're going to treat them. Pause right here on gambling addiction to go to a news update. We're talking with journalist David Clary. He's author of Gangsters to Governors. You can join in this conversation about gambling in America, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. consider the technological advancements in how people gamble using digital money like credit cards or loading up their points on a plastic casino card, it means that betting doesn't feel like spending real money. And those who gamble both online and offline are susceptible to developing gambling addictions, which is what we've been discussing. We're looking at how governors have found themselves in a curious position to manage gambling industries that have this legacy of being controlled by mobsters. David Clary is here. His new book is Gangsters to Governors. Join in the discussion, 800-642-1234. Should states be pinning their financial hopes on gambling, casinos, and other forms of gaming? Are states doing enough to help gambling addictions? You can join in the discussion at 800-642-1234. Going back to gambling addiction, David, and as we're going into the news update there, states have done, all over the map on their importance of what gambling addiction really is and how much money they're putting into the effort and helping people. Some different laws on the books. What do you see in terms of what states are doing?
Yeah, I think on balance, states are not doing a great job of addressing that. You know, when you have more gambling, you're more cases of problem gambling. And I think states see that as an acceptable side effect to increasing gaming. You know, I think they just see it as, well, it's worth it if we can raise, X number of more dollars every year from casinos or from expanding lotteries or whatever. So I think states really should be doing more than they are. You know, I think we have about 5 million people who are considered problem gamblers across the country. And I think part of it is, I think there's still this sense that gambling is a vice, and it's something that it's a moral failing, and people just need to, need to be stronger and somehow resist it. And I think there's just a misunderstanding of that it really is it's a disease, and it's listed as a psychological issue now, and it's not a moral failing. It's just something that, and in these casinos, they develop these games to make people want to play, and they make them very enticing, and they put famous characters on the casinos, and,
like Elvis Presley's face.
Yeah,
how do they make them more enticing?
I was just in Las Vegas last weekend, and I played a Betty White slot machine, and it was very entertaining, and I lost I lost $5. You lose, and she'd have a little wisecrack at you, and there was some video component to it, and it was very enticing, and I'm a very light gambler myself, but I can see how that can be enticing to many people.
And there's also the issue that there are plastic cards that casinos are trying to give you points now, apparently.
Right.
And so you can add up points, and it really doesn't feel like real money.
Right. And I think the casino's mission is to extract money from you as quickly and painlessly as possible. So I remember the days when you'd have to put actual quarters into a machine and then wait for the quarters to tumble out if you won. And now everything is done through cards and done where you don't have to exchange money. So they want to make it as frictionless as possible, make it as easy as possible for you to play and lose. Mm. Because if you don't lose, there's no revenue for the state. So then these players clubs, you accumulate points and you get prizes. Sometimes you get comped on your room or on a buffet or drinks, so that's another enticement for people to play.
Let's go to Eric now in Black River. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, David, I just had one quick question. It was about mainly online gaming, social media gaming. All the casinos, not including Nevada, one of the limitations they have is that you actually have to step into a casino, and, online gaming would allow them to have access to you at any time with a phone, tablet, PC. My question is, there's certain casinos in Vegas like MGM Grand, some other ones, they have Facebook pages. Now, those Facebook pages, you can get free spins, and they're digital slot machines, and instead of earning cash, you earn points. Now, these points can then be redeemed for comps for their casinos. My question is this a loophole that they've found as kind of a first-way access, or is, you know, is this just the beginning, or, I mean, just any insight into social media gaming specifically?
Yeah, that's interesting you bring that up, because we were just in Las Vegas this past weekend, and I noticed that they were promoting this these free spins on Facebook and social media, and by doing that, you would accumulate credits, or you might get a discount on a buffet or something else like that. I think they can do that because they're not promising money in return. It's just it's basically credits or something. You can get a 2-for-1 deal at the buffet. It's not they're not actually paying out real money. So I think that's how they can get around it. But it seems to me a real gray area of gaming, and I think social media has such powerful reach, you know, especially Facebook, that I think that's a really effective tool for these casinos to reach people.
Eric, thanks for that question. David, with smartphones, as you mentioned, we essentially have a casino in our pockets. How should policymakers keep pace with online gambling trends?
Yeah, that's a real big area of gaming. There's going to be lots of change in the years ahead. There already has been some change, but even more will come. Only a few states allow legalize online gaming. And the caller mentioned Nevada. That's one. The online poker is legal there. New Jersey, pretty much every casino game is legal if you're within the state, and also online poker. But and not many states have adopted that, and I think they're just trying to figure out how to regulate it, it's been kind of a slow moving area of gaming, and I don't know. I think you'll see more states enter into that. I think what's happened is the returns have not been. Has happened up to par, you know, according to their projections. Certainly in Nevada, it's not been very good. So I don't know. I think there'll be a slow moving area to watch.
I've always wanted to ask this question, and David, you're just going to get it. I've always been curious with riverboat gamblings and a riverboat on the water. Even though that boat isn't going anywhere, I've heard that they have to have a full-time river captain on the boat, even though that barge is completely moored in. It's soldered in. It can't go anywhere. Is there any truth to that?
That's interesting. I haven't heard that, but okay. there are all kinds of real crazy rules with those casinos, because some are dockside casinos, mm-hmm. So the casino has to be... It could be a boat, but it actually could just be attached to the bar, you know, to a barge. It's mm-hmm. not doesn't actually move anywhere. It would have to be over water in order to offer casinos. So, yeah, that may have been the rule. The captain may have been a rule back in the day. That's interesting. I haven't heard that one.
All right.
Yeah, there are all kinds of just real arcane rules about riverboat gambling. It's just it's really funny.
Let's go to Rick in Sheboygan here very quickly. Hi, Rick. Go ahead.
Yes, your guest made mention that casinos help fund public schools, and therefore states put less money in for those funds for education. And he kind of implied that was bad, that the states weren't putting money in. I just wonder why that is, that he considers money somewhat different. The funds are being supplied to schools no matter where it comes from. Thanks.
Yeah, I think the issue I have with that is that it just seems like that there's a more efficient way of raising money. You know, you think about a state lottery. It requires a large advertising budget, requires a marketing budget. You have to have an office of people to run it. And it just seems like that by the time you pay all those expenses and you pay the winners, you know, the people who win the lottery, you don't really end up with a lot of money. So to me, it just seems like a very inefficient way of raising revenue for something as noble as public education. Whereas if it comes from the general fund, you know, that's money that's raised through taxes or through more direct means. So I don't have any problem with legal lotteries. I think they're fine and they're not going anywhere. So I think it's just the inefficiency of it that bothers me, and the fact that they kind of claim that they're increasing education spending when they're really not, because that part of that money is coming from another source.
Well, Rick, thank you so much for calling in. And as we wrap up here, David, what will gambling look like 10 or 20 years from now? Do we have any idea?
I think, you know, it's always hard to predict, you know, especially how the Supreme Court will rule on a particular case. But I really think that the ground is ready for a large expansion in sports betting, legalized sports betting. So I think in the next, certainly in the next 5 to 10 years, I would expect to see, assuming the federal law banning sports betting is ruled unconstitutional, I think you'll see a lot more states offering that. I think you'll continue to see casino expansions, more slot machines. I think you'll see more online betting. I think some more states will enter that market as well. So I think you'll just see more of it. I don't think you'll see less of it. That much I can be sure.
Well, David, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, it's great to be with you.
David Clary is a journalist and news editor at the San Diego Union-Tribune. His new book is titled Gangsters to Governors, The New Bosses of Gambling in America. This hour of the morning show was produced by Chris Molina, Nyasia Ellison, and Keely Baltina. Michelle Johnson is executive producer and provided technical direction. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this conversation you hear is on the Ideas Network. Coming up Monday at this time, we'll look at the latest political news in Wisconsin and our State Capitol Report. We'll hope you join us Monday at this time for the State Capitol Report. Thanks for listening.